like that fairly often. Do you know there are over 100,000 Canadians in the 20th century who lost that forever? They did something that we don't think of much. They signed a contract that said, I have no right to my own life. If I am ordered to do something that could get me killed, I will say yes, and I will do it, even if I have no hope of surviving. They said, I will do what I am told, maybe not happily, maybe not even willingly, but I will do it even if it means I never see my family again. I never see the children that I know I've conceived. I will never see my parents. I will never be able to take care of them. I'll never see my wife or my fiance. And we let them go. Not happily. I'm sure there was one marriage and one engagement that was broken by a guy's desire to go in spite of his woman's desire to keep him. And a lot of mothers had their hearts broken for the sons and sometimes daughters. We lost 100 women in women's services in World War I and II combined. And we lose them now in places like Vietnam and in training. They had a right, you know. They had a right to keep them. Just like our people had a right to stay home. Why would they give up this right to their own life? Unemployment insurance? A solid $1.25 a day and three meals and a new uniform, which after the Great Depression, I think a lot of Westerners in the 1st Division probably thought was a good bargain. They didn't know what they were getting into, or maybe they did because their ancestors had done exactly the same thing in 1914, which was a rough time in Alberta, and people signed up because it seemed like a good free trip to England because everybody knew the war would be over by Christmas, and they could find more work there than they sure could in Alberta in 1914. We had another depression going on then. A little better than when we had in 1913. Except experience is supposed to teach you something, isn't it? Your dad went to war and said, son, don't ever get in the trenches like I did. Join the Air Force. So we did. And we lost more men in the Air Force in Bomber Command than any other service in World War II. Because we don't know what we're talking about as humans. Men don't know what they're talking about anyway most of the time, right? You know, Jesus says, you know, you're going to make plans to do this and plans to do that. Have you even looked in your own treasury yet? Jesus says, what do we know? Because that's the point. We're remembering on Friday over 100,000 Canadians now, counting the ones we've lost in peacekeeping and in emergencies. How many policemen? You know, we used to have policemen's wives in this congregation. Do we have any now? I don't know. We used to. The Alliance had several policemen's wives when we attended there over the years. What do they think when their husband signs up and goes to work? Or husbands when their wives go to work? Firefighters. I mean, I hear people every day say we should put them into part-time contracts because they don't do anything. We don't have big fires anymore, and we don't have constant fire danger, and people aren't going to die like they used to in fires, and we should just put them on contract. Put them to work when they're spending all that time pumping iron, looking fit, and being in calendars. Maybe we should put them to work doing something really useful like digging ditches or something with that musculature, you know? But there's nobody else we have in the community except maybe ambulance drivers who will run into a burning building for us and consider it normal. But Jesus says here, I want you to look carefully at this crime scene and examine what's going on. And here's the story, and you know why. It's in Luke 10. Alan said he wanted me to preach on this, and I said, well, look, I can just read this and we can all go home. You already know the story so well. You can probably tell it better than I can. So let me just read it from the Revised Standard Version. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, well, what's written in the law? How do you read it? How do you read it? Love that. Lawyers, how do you read it? You know? And he answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said to him, you've answered right. Do this, you will live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him for dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day, he took out 2 denarii. That's about 2 days' wages. So whatever you make a day, double it, okay? And imagine handing that over at Super 8 with or without a receipt. And he gave it to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? And the lawyer said, the one who showed mercy to him. And Jesus said, go and do likewise. Which in the King James is go and do thou likewise. How many people have heard of the Good Samaritan Law? Does anybody here not know about... By the way, if you put your hand up, it doesn't mean you don't know or know. Like, I don't want to single people out who might not have heard of the Good Samaritan. Like, that's the problem. You know, I'm a teacher, right? Say, who's heard of this? Hands go up. Who's not heard of this? Hands go up. Nobody's ashamed, right? But maybe in church it's different. Maybe you don't want to put your hand up and say, I don't know what the Good Samaritan Law is. But here's what it is. If you stop to help somebody, even if you screw up, you can't be sued. Even if you and your best intentions do something wrong, because you stopped and tried to help, the victim or their family can't come after you for not doing it perfectly. How many people have heard the Good Samaritan Law doesn't stand up in court? I hear that all the time. That the Good Samaritan Law doesn't count anymore. That if you stop and try to help people and you get it wrong, you can be sued and go to end all... You know something? That is a lie. I mean, lawyers can have a field day with how they interpret it. But the Good Samaritan Law still stands. It's probably not called that anymore, but we call it that. It's hard, though, isn't it, to be a Good Samaritan? Now, I could go on and rant and rave about how busy we are and we're too busy to help and too much, and something wrong with our society and we've got alienation and, you know, the usual kind of sermon. But that sucks. You already know it. You already know what it means. So let's talk about it differently. Let's talk about it the way it is with people in the story. If I was doing a crime scene investigation, here's what it would look like. On or about 11 a.m. on this date, a man traveling between Jerusalem and Jericho was accosted, beaten, and robbed. Vehicle property stolen, gross bodily harm, broken bones, contusions, loss of blood was high. Person was apparently non-viable if unattended. You know what that all means, right? Nature takes its course, he'll be dead by supper time. Bled out, dehydrated, in pain, incapacitated, probably incontinent, lying in the ditch. The ants are already visiting him. The eagles, which is the Hebrew crossword for vulture, quite often in the New Testament When Jesus says eagle, he means vulture. And quite often when the Jews said vulture, they meant eagle, because that's what Rome was to them, this big evil bird that came down and ate them and picked over their dead. They're circling. They're waiting. Everyone's waiting for nature to take its course. This guy's toast. Probably, you could even say, as the police would say, people who live risky lifestyles don't realize they're leading risky lifestyles. And maybe even say people who lead high-risk lifestyles shouldn't get a lot of extra effort from us to look after them. Because I'll tell you, going alone from Jerusalem to Jericho was a high-risk occupation. That is downhill through some of the deepest, darkest, oldest, most pirate-infested roads in the ancient world. Jericho, we think, was the oldest city ever built by humanity. And it's no coincidence that it wasn't long before it had the oldest walls of any city. Because when you build cities and you build granaries and you gather stuff together and you put your women and children in one place, all the local predators gather around. Because this, of course, is where the pickings are easy. So you build walls and you invent a militia or maybe even an army to protect your stuff and your people. And pretty soon you have a walled town surrounded by free-range opportunists called predators. Human, two-legged predators, looking for life that's a lot easier. And there's nothing easier than getting something for nothing by taking it from someone else. Law of nature, right? Which means that the road between Jerusalem and Jericho is loaded with opportunities for free-range entrepreneurial assault, battery, theft. And if you make too much trouble, well, your life isn't worth that much to me, and my life is worth more than yours. Nothing personal. Just business. Just business. Nothing personal. Just business. Which is why if you travel alone in those places, you better be prepared to give your stuff up without a fight. Because after all, I've never known a predator that's any good. Well, actually, I've known lots of predators that are better than that, but they work alone because they come out of the sky. The ones on ground tend to work in packs, don't they? Wolves, coyotes, Presbyterians, you know what I mean? No, I just threw that one in. I mean, even the guys that come to the door come in twos, right? So here we have then a problem. It's a solo, going solo between Jericho and Jerusalem. Is he not going to give his stuff up like a common sense? He's not got good judgment. He is what probably the priest and Levi thought was, this idiot got himself robbed and killed. He doesn't deserve to be rescued. In fact, if anything, helping him will only enable him to be robbed again, because he obviously doesn't know how to take care of himself. He makes bad choices. And I'm sure say he did. The second bad choice was not handing everything over and walking the other way if they let him. Because witnesses are a problem too, you know, for professionals. Probably the best thing he could have done was volunteered to join them. Here, take my stuff and I'll join you too. Let me help. He might have had a better chance of getting out of that without getting nearly killed. But there he is, nearly dead, and along comes a priest. Subject number two in this investigation. What makes a priest? Inheritance from the great priesthood of Aaron. It's a bloodline. It's also a lifestyle. A lifestyle of being pure. After all, if you're a priest, you build a bridge between God and man. How are you going to do that if you're covered in sin? So you live a sinless life, more or less. You do your best. You work hard. In fact, you work so hard because you know that against the ultimate purity of God and your Bible, your word is full of it in your holy scriptures, of people who play fast and loose with purity. And what happens to them? They make the sound that a fly makes on a modern fly getter in a barnyard when God meets them. Leaving nothing but a bad smell behind. And so a priest, if he is any kind of priest at all, has one preoccupation, purity. Now, I'll tell you a story. There was a Buddhist monk. And he had a prince come and say, How do I become a pure Buddhist monk? And the monk reached over and took a little glass of oil and put it in his hands and said, Carry that from one end of the city to the other and don't spill a drop. And so that aspirant to the Buddhist priesthood took that glass and, staring at it without taking his eyes off it, walked from one end of the city to the other without spilling a drop. And then, just to show how good he was, he turned around and he came all the way back without spilling a drop. And the Buddha said, "Welcome. You have the focus to shut out all of the world's distractions to take care of your soul." What's wrong with the story? Could Jesus tell the story? If he did, it would break his heart. Because here is a man who is pure. So pure, he's walked through a whole city and not noticed another human being in it. Not noticed another human need, another human injustice, another human problem. Has never taken eyes off cultivating his own serenity to care about the world around him. Can we live like that as Christians? Can we put fences up so high that we can walk through life guarding our serenity so carefully we don't even notice that there are stairs here? By the way, I did look before I did this. I practiced, okay? Because you know what happens when you're only fixed on fixing yourself and your own serenity? You clue out to everything. But that's the road to serenity. That's the road, according to the Stoics, to apathy. The ancient Stoics of Jesus' time had a code word, apathy, for the serenity that comes from their philosophy. You literally don't care about anything. That's why you're a Stoic. Nothing moves you. See, it's not a Christian story. But you can be like a Buddhist if you're a priest and all you think about is your purity. You can move through life so focused on your purity that you don't even notice the world around you. And if you notice it, it's only a distraction. And any fool that comes down the road to Jericho by themselves probably can't be saved anyway. Levites, third person in the investigation. Lawyers, servants. If anyone knows how to, they're the adjutant. If you're military, you have a commanding officer, the colonel, usually a lieutenant colonel, really. He says, "This is the objective, men, let's go." His job is to go and die on the objective, which in World War I and II was a fairly frequent occurrence. Now they're at the back of the battle. In those days, they had to be at the front. But beside them is the adjutant. Now, who's the adjutant? The adjutant is a guy that actually makes things work. He's the regimental manager. He's often a major. And that major's job, by the way, the rank of major was created by the king in the old armies to promise and guarantee the actual efficiency of the regiment. In other words, training, organization, efficiency are the adjutant, the major's job. The colonel's a figurehead, a goal setter, a strategist. He's a pointer. And if he goes, well, there's lots more to replace him. That's why they used to say the colonel is a lion, but the adjutant is the fox. Because colonels can be replaced, but adjutants who get the job, they're like sergeants. At the level of the men, the ranker, it's the sergeant who's done everything, knows everything, trains everyone else, and who actually knows how to fire every single weapon properly in the outfit. And he's the dad to those 18, 20-year-olds who hardly know which end is up, who are afraid of the dark until they get trained, who can't hold a compass straight, who put their helmet down in front of their compass and don't notice the needle always points to their helmet because they're clueless until you teach them stuff. The Levite is what makes the temple actually function. He's the adjutant to the priest. If there's any man that knows the rules, every single one, and knows how to apply them, it's a Levite. Tell you, give me a Levite in a firefight. I don't need a priest. I need a Levite. So I can say, how do we get that done? And he says, well, you do this, 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 and this. Ready? Got some guys? Yep, go. Do it. Make it so. Captain Picard, right? But then I'm the only one that watched Star Trek, right? So here's a functionary who knows everything. He's the sergeant. If anybody knows, it's him. And he comes down, and guess what he does? Oh, this is a real bad case. Do you know how contaminating it is to work with a guy who could die on your hands? Touch a dead man? According to our regulations as Torah-keeping Jews, to touch a dead man for nothing makes you unclean. It's one thing for a priest to get his robes dirty. It's another thing for a Levite who knows better to soil himself with the remains of an incontinent, bleeding, dead man. To have the blood of a dead man on your robes when you get to Jericho, people will shun you like you've got leprosy until you cleansed yourself and gone to a priest. You know, we look at emergency workers sometimes in disasters who come covered in the blood of their people they've been treating. We look at doctors who come out of surgery with blood from wiping their hands on their apron. We look at the stuff that comes out of emergency rooms in plastic bags. They used to be clear, probably not anymore. But, and you realize what this means. These are the signs of someone who was needing real help and who shed their blood. And we have to dispose of that in a very special way, because today we believe blood is poison, right? You know, there was a time when doctors didn't wear gloves because they could feel what they were doing better. Now they have to double glove because if they feel something sharp and it goes through their glove and that person has AIDS, they'll die. Some of our best missionary surgeons in Africa in the last 50 years died of AIDS, not because they were practicing gay sex, but because as they operated on dying Africans full of bone fragments and shrapnel, their gloves got punctured and their patients who had HIV communicated the disease to their saviors and they died. Beautiful missionary doctors. I had known a few of them by reputation, none of them personally, but I know their names, and they're gone because they did something they weren't supposed to do. They let somebody's toxic blood get on them and in them. Any Levite then knows what to do. Put a 10-foot pole mark on that guy and stay away. Nothing but trouble. He's probably dead anyway. One, two, three. Fourth subject, the Samaritan. If there's somebody with a wall around him that no one should cross, it's a Samaritan. Let me tell you why. We all know Samaritans don't like Jews and Jews don't like Samaritans. You haven't been in church very much if you haven't heard that before. They didn't. Here's why. When the northern kingdom that Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel, all those characters were in, were finally conquered, they were conquered by the Assyrian Empire. This is about 100 or so years before Jerusalem. And the Assyrians had a policy. Because people tended to be stuck so much on their God and their land, the best way to prevent rebellions was to deport them someplace else where their God didn't live and which was not their land. It killed their nationalism and their tendency to rebel. So you hauled them off somewhere else and you put in replacement people who didn't have that connection. So, those 10 tribes disappear, and we still call them the 10 lost tribes. And we find Jewish synagogues in the weirdest places over the centuries, possibly as a result. China, for example. There's a medieval synagogue in China. How did that ever get there? We don't know. Probably through Babylon, but we don't know. So what happens then is the people living in the northern half of what used to be the Holy Land, the land united and fought for by David and Solomon, are foreigners. They have a place, a capital city called Samaria. They have a mountain called Mount Gerizim. But you know, bless their hearts, they become followers of Yahweh and they get a Torah. They build a temple on Mount Gerizim. And they say, we are the followers of Yahweh. And this is our homeland. And he is our God. Now, just as they do that, the Babylonians come in, thump Jerusalem on the head for the last and final time. It's been a bad kid in the empire anyway. Haul them all off, and for 70 years, they're not even there. Which means the only followers of Yahweh are the Samaritans, living in Samaria, this land just north of Jerusalem, with their little temple on Mount Gerizim. And this drives Jewish nationalists crazy. That you would dare to think Mount Gerizim is the temple of the Lord. That you would dare to think that little hill is his holy mountain. That you would dare to think, you mongrels, that you are keepers of Torah. Even your Torah is not exactly, there was a few things they changed about it. And they did have a messianic figure in their prophecies. But they only had the five books. See, the Samaritans didn't use Psalms. They didn't use Proverbs. They didn't use the poetry. They didn't use the other books. They just had the first five. That was all they had. That's why in some ways they were closer to the Sadducees than they were to the rest of the Jews in Jesus' country. So not only are they mongrels, they don't even believe the right things. Their little religion is a tin can copy on a tin can mountain with a tin can people and a tin can God. And you get the Holy Land, or at least half of it, and we got nothing. And then they come back. And guess what happens? Read your book of Nehemiah. Read your book of Ezra. The Jews start rebuilding a temple, a priesthood. They're going to restore this temple on the Holy Mount of Zion. And the Samaritans say, what? We were here, and you weren't. How can this Jerusalem thing you're building be valuable? And as a result, Sanballat, who is the governor, he's the villain of Nehemiah, right? He's a Samaritan. He and his people living north of Nehemiah and Ezra put everything that they can on the project to can and kill the Nehemiah-Ezra project. The people of Samaria are led by their leaders to suffocate the return to the Holy Land of the Jews because, well, they don't have a right. They're the losers. Well, as you can imagine, this is a recipe for rivalry, competition, eye gouging, groin kicking, elbowing in the corners, and a lot of high sticking between the two of them. And in fact, in the 2nd century BC, the Jews go north and they sack, destroy, and burn that secondary temple on Mount Gerizim, and they rub it into the dirt. Which is why when Jesus talks to the Samaritan woman, she says, we still worship on our holy mountain, amid the ruins of what you Jews did to us, waiting for the Messiah. What have you got, Jesus? The bad blood, then, is not just institutional and theological. It's physical. There are ruins up there, people, of what the Jews did to us. No wonder Jews don't want to go through Samaria to get to Galilee. They'll go 100 miles out of their way on the other side of the Jordan to stay out of that kind of friction. When Jesus goes through Samaritan towns, in one case, they reject him. There comes a bunch of Jews, all 13 of them, and they're women. Throw them out. And the disciples say to Jesus, hey, can we call down fire on them? Remember that story? Jesus says, drop it. He says that several times in his own inimitable way. Drop it. But that's what I mean. This is the baggage of hatred and rejection. This is the guy with the 10-foot fence around him, put there invisibly by the Jews everywhere he goes. Nobody on the road between Jericho and Jerusalem wants to see him. He's probably immune to some of the burglars if they're keeping kosher. Don't touch the Samaritan. Or even worse, don't touch the Samaritan because he's one of us. He hates Jews too. After all, in the Holy Land, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Samaritan, therefore, is literally a reject. He's lived that life. He's in the territory of the very people that for 200 years have actually acted physically against him and his religion and are poisoned against him so deeply that they don't even want to talk to him. Do you know if that victim was even semi-conscious? To know that a Samaritan was giving him first aid should have been enough for him to gasp out between chapped lips and broken teeth, take your filthy hands off me. I would rather die than be ministered to by one of you. That's the level of hate in Jesus' country. I would rather die. Take your filthy hands off me. I have a friend who said that once. He was in England at the Greenwich Naval Museum doing some research on a book on British Navy. He was going up the stairs one day and Prince Philip walked the other way. Double take. Was that Prince Philip? Yes, that was Prince Philip. He leaps to look over the balcony and suddenly he's in a headlock and an arm lock so tight he can't breathe. Because, of course, Prince Philip had a Royal Marine in plainclothes being security. Poor Don's gasping for breath, saying, take your filthy hands off me. And the sergeant says, sorry, sir, no hard feelings, just doing my job. Boing, lets him go. You made a fast move in the presence of His Highness. My job is to immobilize you until we determine what kind of threat you are. Take your filthy... Well, actually, I was doing my constituted job, and my hands aren't filthy, and Don had to admit, yeah, I guess you were right to do that. Because I did look dangerous, didn't I? Well, this is not that situation, is it? And you know, the Samaritan, maybe he even heard that. Maybe the guy was able to gasp that out through his broken teeth and bloody jaw and say, I don't want you to touch me. No, no. I'd rather die than be touched by a Samaritan. And the Samaritan pushed through that kind of treatment and did two things. You know why he put wine on the wounds, eh? Got a bit of alcohol, probably helped clean them out a little bit. You know why he put oil on the wounds? To soothe the pain caused by the wine. After all, who wants alcohol put on their wounds, right? When I was a kid, it was Dettol or alcohol to put on a cut. And we always asked Mom for the Dettol because it didn't hurt as much as the alcohol did. Dettol comes from Britain. Alcohol comes from, I don't know, Procter & Gamble probably. And we didn't want alcohol. It burns. So then you put something on top of that, right? Oil. A little olive oil on a burning wound soothes it, right? He ties up the wounds. He puts them on his own donkey, which means he probably let the guy ride in his own V-Wagon bug that's been around used since he bought it used in the old Samaritan used car lot. It's probably an original VW, which means it's got no heat, no fan, seats about 250 people if they're students, and sounds like a tank. And in that disreputable old thing, he rumbles into Jericho and finds a hotel. Now, again, Jericho, it's a mixed town. They probably had a Gentile section and a Jewish section, so you can imagine which hotel he's in. He's in the Gentile section down in the lower end where the Gentiles have their hotels. And he finds a place and he puts this guy in the room and he says, look, I'm going to stay with him tonight. I'm going to change his diaper. I'm going to change the bed sheets when he heaves because head injuries make you heave. If you've ever had one, you know what I'm talking about. Nobody talks about it, but a good concussion always leads to a great bout of nausea. I'm going to fix all that stuff up tonight. And when I leave him in the morning, I'm going to pay you to do the same thing for the next 2 days if you have to. And when I come back, I'll pick up the rest of the tab. Now, if I was a reporter on this, a police reporter, I would say that this Samaritan, well, wouldn't it depend? I guess if I was a Jewish cop, I'd say, this is extraordinary. This is unnatural. In fact, I'd probably question my witnesses if there were any. I might go back and I might reinvestigate with the priest and the Levite. I might even come back and write a report because my supervisor's Jewish that says something about how this Samaritan really did something unnatural and probably something counterproductive because he enabled a fool to carry on his foolish, dangerous lifestyle when it would have been much better and less use of money to simply let the guy die, bury him quietly, put him away, and carry on with their business. This is probably a waste of time and money enabling someone who's only going to make bad choices for the rest of their life. But if I were a Samaritan cop, what would I write? Here's a fool that went out of his way, sacrificed his resources, sacrificed his time, sacrificed, put his own life at risk for a loser. Someone who made bad choices. Someone who probably won't be grateful. Someone who will make nothing but trouble. Someone who won't even say thank you. Isn't it great that Jesus doesn't care about that? Because there's another person in the story. The teller. The storyteller himself who tells the story. Because you see, you guys have your blank sheet of paper in your bulletins? Or a sheet with nothing on it? Ah, yes, I'm a teacher. There's homework. Here's your homework. You see, the storyteller knows that a parable should be a proverb with a story. This is something I learned from the PACE program by reading my wife's notes. We share everything. Jesus tells parables instead of giving proverbs. Have you noticed that? We have proverbs about how to do things. And they're often around boundaries, right? There's rules about how to deal with sluggards. I read them with great discomfort because Carol always reads them to me. Oh, thou sluggard, get up from thy bed, you know. Be like the ant, not the grasshopper. whatever, you know, that there are proverbs to make people live better. There are rules to make people live better. There are boundaries to make people do better. And they're all over the book of Proverbs. Jesus never does a proverb. He says, I'll tell you a story. But the parable often leads to a lesson that could be made into a proverb, couldn't it? So here's your homework. Sit down sometime in the next 7 days and make this story into a proverb. Write your own application as if it were a proverb. What would Jesus like you to take out of this and make into a proverb that you could actually remember? Well, it comes into the question, right? And Jesus asks the best questions, right? When Jesus asks a question, you can't stay the same if you answer it. And if you don't answer it, you're not the same anyway because he asked it and you can't get it out of your head. Who then was the neighbor? Who then was the neighbor? Now, it's interesting. If you actually look at the words being used, the word compassion, it's the same word Jesus has. It's the same word used when Jesus feels something for someone who's suffering in their gut. The word compassion means that this Samaritan had the same feelings of movement, of emotion that Jesus had for the suffering. This Samaritan, who shouldn't even know better, feels like Jesus when he sees hurt people. Secondly, the word neighbor is the same word used for the guy next door. It means the human being closest to you. Now, if that's the word being used, who is the neighbor? How should we behave to the people closest to us? You know, I told the children the story of my mother because my mother was known and still is, even though she's not living there anymore, as the best neighbor on our highway. Betty Creerar's kitchen was open to anyone. Betty Creerar's front door would be open to anyone. And when Ian was there, so much the better. Dad was different. Dad would size a guy up because Dad had been out in the world of business. Dad had been a war orphan. Dad knew that the world was full of hard, bad, awful things and pretty not nice people. Dad would take a second look, you know. But, you know, under the influence of my mother, Dad became a man that opened the door too. He didn't lock his freezer. He didn't lock his fridge. People came in our door at the weirdest times. They sat at our table. We almost never had a meal without somebody we didn't know at the table or somebody we knew who was at the table for their 47th time. The minister never had to cook. We had a lot of visiting ministers because we couldn't afford to have one of our own. We had a lot of visiting ministers, and they came back, and we had a lot of ministers at our table. It's a wonder I'm not one by association. Like some genetic spread from one to the other, you know. Hang around ministers long enough, you turn into one, right? Well, maybe. But you know something? It meant that Betty and Ian Creerar's home was the most hospitable place on Highway 31 between Vernon, Ontario, and the city of Ottawa. And people knew that. Remember the day I came into our place, and we had our sales room in the back door, and there was this kid sleeping in the back door with our guard dog beside him. Thanks, Boots. Not a bark. He'd come in the night, bedded down for the night because it was raining, with our guard dog. Thanks, Boots. Boots was a border collie. He probably figured he was shepherding this vagrant. So, come and have breakfast. What's your story? By the way, it happened again just about 5 years ago when I was home visiting. Somebody turns up at the door, and they end up sleeping on our couch all night and getting breakfast in the morning. Because Mom and Dad were Samaritans. They took this story, and they made it their proverb. I think that was so cool of my parents. I didn't agree with them about a lot of stuff. Dad and I started arguing about politics when I was 9. But on the other hand, man, I hope I can be like them. I'm proud of that. But you know something? In Jesus' day, nobody did that. And this young man trying to justify himself. Now, it kind of sounds like, okay, he knows the answer was too easy. Do this and you will live. Jesus, you're setting me up. I look like a slacker. I ask you an easy question. I get an easy answer. I collect brownie points. I don't know about that, whether the young man, the lawyer, is actually insecure and looking for reassurance or whether he's trying to... I think there's something else going on there. I think he doesn't know how to apply this passage. How do you love the Lord with all your strength and your neighbor as yourself? I think he knows the rule, but he doesn't know how to apply it. He's not a Levite, or he's a Levite in training, you might say. I don't know how to apply this. I'm new at this game. Jesus, talking to you is like talking to somebody I never talked to before. When you talk about the Bible, I feel like I've never read it before. When you talk about the kingdom of God, I feel like I've never heard about it before. And now you're saying, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who is my neighbor? And Jesus says, learn from the Samaritan who your neighbor is. That's your real neighbor. The one who you wouldn't let touch you, but has my guts, has my heart, who will respond to compassion the same way that any normal person will respond to compassion. They don't have filthy hands. They have hearts. They are your neighbor. So if you write a proverb based on this parable, make sure you include the Samaritan in the proverb and ask yourself, who am I in this picture? Am I the priest? Am I the Levite? Pretty hard for us to fall into those roles because we've been with this story now for 2,000 years. And if you've been coming to church, you know what the right answer is, right? But on the other hand, do we forget how? Are you the Samaritan? Cool. Are you the lawyer? I don't know how to apply this anymore. Do I open my door to danger? Do I go out of my way? Do I throw stuff at people who might not deserve it? Do I accept help from people who I wouldn't want to have in my living room? Can I be ministered to by somebody from an ethnic group that I can't accept? What happens if I wake up on the street and it's an African Muslim giving me mouth-to-mouth resuscitation? How do I react? Do I shudder and back away? Or do I say, thank God you were here and didn't care about the boundaries that we put up? I know this is a fact because I know right now the man who is our Minister of Defense is a man who wouldn't even be allowed into an Alberta Legion 30 years ago. And yet he served in Afghanistan 3 tours, put his life on the line, and a man who respects and loves our chaplains even though they're not Sikhs, they're Christians. I'll tell you, that makes me humble. That's what we have the chance to do here, is to face the fact that in our world right now, we're probably Samaritans. How many non-Christians in Grand Prairie really love to be with us? Or do you give people a bad conscience just by being there? Oh, here comes the Christian, the guy from Church of Christ. Find another table. Find another subject. Stay out of his church. They only ask for money. You know the talk. I mean, Alan asked me once, why don't I bring my friends to church? And the answer is, any friends I have left hate the church so much they've got all the answers before I can get them in the door. It's going to take a miracle for God to reach them. And then I felt like I just identified a Samaritan. I wouldn't let into my congregation until they're ready. What does that mean? You know, who am I? Am I the rich young ruler? Am I the lawyer? Or am I a priest or a Levite? We have to ask ourselves, what part are we playing in this story? Because that's what Jesus asked us to do. Do you know how many brown people or Christians have come into this country? From Egypt? Anglicans from Egypt. Can you imagine there are Anglicans in Egypt? Anglicans in Lebanon? Are Anglicans Christians? I suppose some people in Church of Christ might have to ask themselves that question. But when they pray, boy, Baptists, Presbyterians, you know, we have a huge Lebanese Presbyterian mission. How many people who are Filipinos are already Christians? One of the things our government used to forget was they were worried about who is a real Christian coming to Canada and preserving Christian Canada, when so many of our Chinese and Filipinos are already converted by missionaries. Do we really know what we're talking about when we talk about immigration? I don't think we do until we've read this story again and again and asked ourselves, who am I? Who am I? Lord Jesus, if we think we have the answers, show us that we don't even know the questions. And if we ask you to answer our questions, take us to your parables and teach us through them to be like you. In your holy name, Jesus.